Hello, everyone, and welcome to Queens of the Bees, your favorite queer movie podcast, and ours too. I am your fabulous co-host, TJ, the ever-exuberant, full of viv and verve Pisces TJ.
Full of something.
Shit, really. Full of dick, that's... No. Anyway, let's not be vulgar. As you were saying, and who are you?
I'm Aaron.
Who is?
The other host of this podcast.
Right, and he is an Aries. He is what? How do we distill Aaron into an essence?
Aloof.
Aloof. That's an enigma. That's what I would say. An enigma. Anywho, we're coming before you this week to talk about a movie that is now 20 years old, which is crazy to think about.
Mm-hmm.
Party Monster, which stars, I should say, Macaulay Culkin and Seth Green. And since we're living in a golden age of Culkins, since Macaulay's younger brother Kieran is all over the television these days as a result of his role in Succession, this seems like a particularly pertinent movie, even though it has literally nothing to do with Succession.
And of course, Macaulay appeared in that American Horror Story
season. He did. He did. That is true, which we did not talk about on this podcast yet. But... Mm-hmm. We'll do season whatever that was.
Yeah, and season 4000 or whatever we're up to.
Who knows? He may be back. I mean, Kim Kardashian is, or one of the Kardashians, I don't remember, is going to be in the new season.
It'll be something.
I mean, Patti LuPone is also going to be in it, and she's been very scathing, but anyway, we digress.
Yes.
Back to Party Monster for the moment. So how would you summarize this film, which is kind of like a cotton candy acid fest, but...
Yeah, it's kind of like this weird sort of almost like can't believe it stereotyped weird fantasy of what queer club life would have been like. It's so over the top, except, of course, it's true. That's my favorite part of how ridiculous everything about this movie is. Because it's true.
It is true. So the film is about Michael Alec, who was one of the club kids of the early 80s, which, for a small town kid from Appalachia, when I watched this movie 15 years ago, I was like, I literally had never heard of the club kids before, but I'm kind of a rube sometimes when it comes down to it, for all of my pretensions and all that. Aaron's giving me a very long-suffering look. Anyway, so it's about Michael Alec, who becomes friends with James St. James, that Seth Green... Macaulay Culkin is Michael Alec. They kind of become these party folk in New York City in the 80s, but their lives begin to unravel, particularly Michael's, when a drug deal goes bad with Angel, his drug dealer, who is then murdered, and Michael ends up going to prison for manslaughter. And, fun fact, the real Michael Alec just died a couple of years ago, tragically of a heroin overdose. But, you know, he was... briefly emerged into the news again as a result of that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot going on in this film. It is worth pointing out that Michael is gay, but also possibly pan, because he does end up with having a passionate affair with Chloe Sevigny's character. So he maybe, as we would say it now, was pan or bi or something. I'm not sure that Michael really thinks that deeply about anything. So what I wanted to talk about first, and then you can sort of chime in as you like, was Macaulay Culkin as a star persona.
Yes.
Which is arguably the biggest selling point of this film when it came out, because this was his sort of return to the movies after Richie Rich was released in 94. So, you know, here we have Macaulay Culkin, arguably like the biggest child star of the early 90s.
And now he's a young man. Right. He's a grown-up.
He is a grown-up. And in some unfortunate ways, his own... meteoric rise to fame and sort of fall from grace mirrors that of Alec a little bit. I mean, admittedly, Macaulay Culkin didn't murder anyone.
As far as we know.
But he did have issues with substance abuse and sort of spiraling, as is not uncommon with child stars. So it struck me as I was watching it, the extent to which that's clearly sort of tying in. And what gives his performance some moments of tragedy, like there's an archness in a kind of... it's almost twee in his way he's delivering his lines with Michael, which reads as inauthentic and artificial and almost like bad acting, except we know that Macaulay Culkin can act because he's, you know, we've seen him in other things, so we know he has ability. So there's a sort of theatricality that I think lends itself to camp.
Yeah, but it's like we see the same thing in Seth Green's performance as James St. James. And I think it's because that sort of artificial camp stylized way of thinking, or way of speaking and presenting oneself, is actually true to life for those two people. Because what we have is things that I think, again, like you kind of hinted at, could be things that could be dismissed as sort of bad performances from the two stars of the movie that are actually kind of spot on portrayals of these larger than life, real life people.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking of that scene very early in the movie when they meet at like a donut shop, and then James St. James sort of is introducing Michael to the performance, the performativity of like club culture, and like you sort of the holding court, not dissimilar to like drag balls in some ways, like of like Pose and Paris is Burning, in the sense of you put on a performance so that you are to be seen and to be looked at, and they sort of parade around this donut shop while a rather large obvious drag queen looks on rather bemusedly, as does the person, the clerk. Like, it's a very fascinating scene just because it's such a distillation of who they both are, and they how Michael is getting sort of interpolated into this new world from his small, you know, middle America upbringing.
Exactly.
And I mean, it is worth pointing out, like, there's a scene very early, because all of this is Brecht. So one of the things that interests me in this story is its narrative structure, because it begins and ends with James St. James giving a television interview about a book he's written called Disco Bloodbath, which is obviously real. And so, you know, it's his desire as a character, and perhaps even as a real person, to sort of seize control of this story. But there's a moment when he goes to Michael's house, and they're sitting in bed tripping, I think, on heroin. Maybe? I don't know. I'm not a drug expert. And then in that moment, Michael sort of starts to seize control of the story. And it's a really interesting sort of narrative choice, storytelling choice, especially since that's the sort of moment when Michael begins to sort of unveil for us, the viewer, his own deeply traumatic upbringing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is undeniably traumatic. And it's sort of juxtaposed with his mother's point of view, who was played by an actress who was in another camp classic, Mommy Dearest, as Christina Crawford.
Yes, Diana Scarwood. So you can say her name, TJ. Say her name.
Well, I couldn't remember it, so I was relying on you for that. I'm not great with names. So that's an interesting sort of intertextuality in terms of its sort of camp canonicity, I suppose you would say.
They knew what they were doing.
Yes, exactly. They knew what they were doing. And we're going to talk about Mommy Dearest on this podcast in celebration of Mother's Day. So a little preview of coming attractions. But as be that as it may. So, you know, Michael's sort of more self-aware and arch relating of his trauma is juxtaposed to his mother's more sanguine, one might almost say willfully naive understanding of what her son has gone through.
Yeah, and exactly. And what I was thinking about with his backstory is that it's oddly true to life that someone like Michael would be, given the things that he experienced as a kid, would be kind of screwed up to the point where he doesn't recognize the extent to which he's screwed up, and there's a lot that he thinks is normal that really isn't normal. And we can see that that's how he sort of relates to everyone around him. He's got all kinds of very obvious intimacy issues, and not like intimacy like he can't get close to folks, but he will throw himself directly at people right away. Like, it's like more like he has no boundaries or no appropriate ones, as opposed to someone who maybe can't get close, which is a bit more like James St. James, who tends to keep people at bay a little bit more.
Right. That's an interesting like juxtaposition that I think you're drawing attention to, because Michael's tweeness and his archness and his artificiality feels to me like a cocoon that he's developed to sort of deal with the trauma of being molested as a child, with, you know, being abandoned and, you know, all that kind of thing. Whereas James St. James's feels very much more, to elaborate a little bit on Michael, like, it feels there's a rawness there that just sort of lurks under the surface. It's there, and it becomes clear as the film goes on in his efforts to sort of keep the artifice going, become ever more sort of feverish and overwrought and frantic. Whereas James St. James from the beginning, seems much more deliberate and much more in control of, mm-hmm. of the story, of his own bodily self. Like, mm-hmm. he's always much more self-contained than Michael.
Exactly.
And he's also more clothed than Michael, now that I'm thinking about mm-hmm. it. Like, the elaborateness of his costuming really is a carapace.
Exactly.
And, it cocoons him. Michael is so much more, we see so much more of Michael's body mm-hmm. throughout the film, which yeah. has now occurred to me as I was sitting
exactly
here.
And that's what the kind of stuff that I was getting at, where it's like he will in those ways sort of throw himself mm-hmm. At folks, whereas James St. James is more reserved. And I like that we get those two depictions of folks who very clearly had some struggles, who've had some hard experiences, and those different ways of being as a result.
Right, and that's where I think the performance style and the sort of star text involved are, and even their physical appearance, are so important, because Macaulay Culkin, as he's grown older, has sort of maintained that kind of, it's not exactly childlike, there's a sensuousness to his face. Mm-hmm. Like, it's in there in the curl of his lips, it's there in the way, his eyes have mm-hmm. a certain twinkle. Like, there's almost, it's almost cherubic, I think is probably the best way, and it's never really shed. You know, mm-hmm. he had that as Kevin, obviously, in Home Alone, but as he's grown older, it's still there, so it lends his character, it lends Michael a vulnerability that I think is very mm-hmm. evocative.
Yeah.
Where Seth Green is always kind of funny, he's mm-hmm. always kind of, there's a brittleness sometimes, yeah. and a sort of raw, how do I want to describe it? Brittleness, because it's there, when he plays Scott in Austin Powers, which is arguably his biggest role up till this one. Mm-hmm. And so I think that helps to underscore the different kinds of characters that we get with these two people. Mm-hmm. And you say that Michael throws himself at everyone, and it's true. Like, we see it when he meets Dylan McDermott's character, who, I swear, Dylan McDermott has not aged.
Yeah, it's like
a bit, he looks, but he also has. But.
Exactly. It's like he looks older now than he did in this, but somehow also looks exactly the same in the movie as the way that he looks now.
He has that same kind of intense physical or male eroticism as John Stamos, who ironically also makes an appearance mm-hmm. in this movie, which we'll get to that in a moment. You can sense...
Actually, now that you think about it, a lot of the side characters in this are men who have aged extremely well.
It's true.
That could be, the subtitle for this movie, if they were to, re-release this now. It could be Collection of Men Who Have Aged Beautifully.
It's true. I mean, even Macaulay, who admittedly has put his body through a lot, has mm-hmm. aged pretty well from yes. what we saw in American Horror Story, and so has Seth Green, who looks pretty much the same, which is weird. But anyway, you're right. There is a lot of male beauty on display in this in this film, including Wilmer Valderrama, which mm-hmm. Who makes an appearance as DJ Keoki, who is still alive. Mm-hmm. I have to clarify because it's drug-addled people from the 80s. It could go either way. Exactly. Plus, they're all in the queer community, which it is striking to me now that I think about it that there's no mention of AIDS.
Michael lies about James having AIDS when he talks about to explain one of his hospitalizations or something like that.
That's right, he does do that. That's the only mention, which I find, admittedly no film can elaborate on everything, but it is striking to me that in a film set in the queer community of the 80s in New York City.
But it isn't the 80s that you're thinking of. It's the very late 80s into the 90s, and these are very young guys on the scene. So they're not the group that would have been active when AIDS was still a secret, and so lots of folks were getting it.
That's true.
They're a little bit younger than that.
True.
And so they would have more awareness of it as they age to the point of becoming, sexually active and all that stuff.
That's true. So it is, it is interesting to me, as you say, that Michael throws himself at everyone, first at Dylan McDermott's character, then at DJ Keoki /Wilmer Valderrama, who, again, has not aged at all. Mm-hmm. It's really uncanny how, but also Wilmer, who doesn't have much to do in this film, there's a certain sort of sensitivity, I think, that mm-hmm. Wilmer captures very well in his depiction of DJ Keoki. Right.
And then since you've talked so much about Wilmer Valderrama, we have to talk specifically about Wilson Cruz, who's also in the movie. And since, like you mentioned, DJ Keoki, played by Wilmer Valderrama, is still alive. Obviously, Angel Hernandez, played by Wilson Cruz, not still alive, because that's kind of the point of the movie. Right. Wilson Cruz plays the murder victim at the heart of the real-life story.
Right.
Of all of these folks. So, of course, tragically, he's been dead ever since then. But Wilson Cruz delivers what, for me, as I think back to my first time watching this movie, was a truly masterful performance, because it was nice to see him as yet another young actor who had a little bit of chance to grow up and become really sort of a man, as opposed to someone who was still kind of a boy from his days in My So-Called Life. You know, now he's a bit older, and we see a very sort of manly kind of Wilson Cruz emerging alongside of the slightly grown up versions of Seth Green and Macaulay Culkin that we get as well. Like I said, for me, thinking about how important this movie was to me watching it back when it came out, but now being an older person, looking back and having watched it again, those things stick out so much to me because of how grown up they seem compared to their earlier personas, but how young they still seem as characters in this movie.
And there is something almost poignant about this movie, sometimes even despite itself, because clearly, like, the first roughly half of it is very much about the exuberance and the sort of hedonism of Michael and his life as a club kid, as someone who really is a masterful bullshitter. Like, the entire sort of edifice of elevating this club that Dylan McDermott is running is all basically smoke and mirrors. Like, there's no substance to it at all. We could call this American Horror Story, like, New York City, the addendum, like, in some ways, because I mean, we in the audience know that Michael is sort of riding high, but, you know, heading for a sort of catastrophic fall, which is exactly what happens. And so, you know, we're sort of immersed in this strange, ethereal, bizarro world that Michael has constructed for himself. And there's something, you know, tinged with tragedy about it. I think, you know, I when we were doing the pregame, I said to you that, like, parts of this remind me of, it's as if we have a little bit of the sort of queer tragedy of Tiger King melded to the similarly tragic but sort of exuberant visuality of Hedwig in The Angry Inch. Like, I feel like, if I don't know why, that there's sort of, I feel this commonality between these, but it just seems to me that there's, it feels like those kinds of stories are feeding in here, even though they're obviously not at all connected.
But there's something, I think, connecting them in all of those sort of, you know, sort of in various ways queer tragedies. There's something about sort of like the spectacle of club life for Party Monster, or like the spectacle of Tiger King, or the spectacle of performance in Hedwig, that is kind of like a refuge, you know, that, you know, for our community, it's sort of historically been what we've turned to. We turn to that flair for performance, that flair for spectacle, that flair for the image, as a way of dealing with some of the hard stuff.
No, I think I like that. And I think that, as I, you know, alluded to earlier, that for all of these characters, James St. James and Michael particularly, like, the exuberance and the theatricality of it all is a means of coping with trauma and sort of keeping the world at arm's length. So, you know, I would be remiss if I did, you know, I alluded earlier to the fact that we see Chloe Sevigny, who plays, you know, a young woman whose path crosses with Michael and he begins an affair with her. But we also have Natasha Lyonne. So all of these people are, you know, still very much a presence in Hollywood. It's always a pleasure to see them. Admittedly, Natasha Lyonne doesn't have a whole lot to do as, you know, this sort of drug manufacturer character. But it is nevertheless fun to see her. And of course, that she stars with Chloe Sevigny in an episode of Peacock's Poker Face. So this is one of those films that just feels very relevant, even though it's, you know, not particularly, but it just, all the people who are in it have had recent appearances that are really fun. And credit to Chloe Sevigny for being in pretty much every indie queer drama of the mid-2000s. Like, she's in this, she's in, obviously, Boys Don't Cry. It's just, she's really adept at playing these very, not, I don't want to say broken, but young women who sort of exist on the margins of society. Like, I think that that's a role that she has excelled at creating, and she plays on it, even if her most recent role in Poker Face. And I love that about her, because there's just something really soulful in, again, tragic about her performances. And it's here as well, because, you know, she gets sucked into Michael's, the maelstrom of Michael's life. And we don't really find out much of what happens to her after he's arrested. She just kind of disappears from the story.
But then ultimately we do find out what happens.
Oh, What do you want to tell us?
Well, spoiler alert, she dies.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Drug overdose.
Yeah. Yeah, so I
forgot. And that news is delivered to Michael by James.
That's right.
While Michael's in jail making the phone call to interrupt the TV interview.
That's right.
happening. It's like, and I love the delivery of it because it's so sincere. Or it's sincere as James St. James was capable of being when he delivers the sad news where he's like, oh, you haven't heard. She's dead.
Right. I somehow have forgotten that. But I'm glad you... This is why we have a co-host, so he can fill in the gaps, if you'll pardon the laden pun, as it were. Anyway, we don't want to get too far off. So, you know, that is yet another reminder of just how all of these club kids are sort of dancing on the lip of a volcano. Mm-hmm. Like, you never know when it's going to come crashing down.
Yeah.
As it turns out, much faster than...
Right. And for me, as when I think about this depiction of especially these folks who would have been very young to be on the club scene, you know, frankly, too young. When the movie starts, they're too young to be going to clubs, but they're going anyway.
Yes.
But looking at it now and looking at those folks as sort of like the early sort of Gen X folks out on the scene, it's interesting to see the sort of the pathway of destruction, how for them it wasn't. As you pointed out before, TJ, it wasn't like because of AIDS.
Right.
It was this pathway of sort of self-destruction for a lot of them. But it's self-destruction that at its core is sort of like caused by trauma.
Right.
So it's not like these are just young folks who've just made bad decisions. It's like these are young folks who got a bad start in life in a lot of ways.
Right.
And who ended up because of that on a pathway to kind of burn out for a lot of them. That sort of has to end in tragedy for a lot of them. Which sadly parallels real life because, of course, this is a real life story.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, we see just how famous they become. Because, you know, I alluded earlier to the fact that John Stamos plays a very, very late 80s, early 90s talk show host. Like, I mean, they got that look exactly.
Yep.
Like, they, if you did not grow up in that era, it's kind of hard to explain to you the absolute, and this also feels relevant since Jerry Springer just died. Like, it's really hard to, because television, just the landscape is so different now than it was in the early 90s. Like, just how ubiquitous talk shows were. Everyone had a talk show, Ricky Lake and, you know, all these other things. So it's an interesting sort of callback to an earlier media atmosphere, and that's where we see Michael sort of constructing his own image at James's expense.
Yep.
And he seems to take an inordinate amount of joy in needling James as much as he can get away with.
Yep, exactly.
And of course, as I said, John Stamos is there, and that's one of those moments that there are moments in this movie that feel almost like John Watersy, because there's just so many sort of, it's almost like bricolage, like pulling together all these different, I don't know what you want to call them, jagged pieces to form. I'm really a poetic today.
Right.
These jagged pieces to make this mosaic of this story. It just feels very John Watersy.
Exactly, and that's what I feel about the casting of Marilyn Manson
in
just the very small part of the movie, but very prominently featured. It's like just, that feels again more like, I don't want to say gimmick because I don't think that's the right word, but it feels like more like a gesture toward what you were just talking about than sort of a sincere casting choice.
Right, especially since that character in particular is a travesty. And I mean that in multiple ways. She is a sort of drag performer that Michael wants to make into a star, but also takes a great deal of joy in humiliating as visibly as possible.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, I don't know that I would have even known, because I'm not a huge Marilyn Manson fan, never have been. I had to look it up to affirm that it was Marilyn Manson, who has also been in the news recently. And it's just, as you say, it's an interesting casting choice. And it's one of those things that I think is very much why this film seems sort of torn in a productive way. There's a tension in this film that Roger Ebert alluded to between horror, and he calls it like comedy, but I would actually say it's camp. Like, the horror and the camp exists in a productive tension, as they so often do. And it's also interesting to me that, like, this was something we were talking about, is the way that this film, as emerging in the early 2000s, is imagining what life looked like, 15, 20 years previously. So it's, you know, there's not as much time between this movie and Us as there is between this movie and its time of production. Yeah. Actually, a little bit more. Yeah. So I wondered if you, would you like to elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, and one thing I'll do is that you said the movie's sort of like imagining life like 15 years prior. I'm going to just amend that a little bit and say that it's actually reflecting that. Because again, this is a real life story. Like the basic of events of this story happened for real. Like this, it's one of those kind of stories. So we're getting this sort of glimpse at the past and sort of reflecting on kind of what life was like. And for me, that's something I kind of wanted to take a little bit of time to explore, because I remember watching the movie back when it came out and then rewatching it, of course, for the podcast. So, of course, when the movie came out, I was around the age of the characters when the movie was set. So, you know, so I was kind of, you know, a young adult, kind of enjoying life and all that kind of stuff. And having seen that sort of model of Club Kid New York as sort of a model for queerness, as a younger queer person, having seen that model when it was the image in the 80s, or late 80s and early 90s, having seen that and thought, well, maybe that's my future or whatever as a queer person, looking to that. But then watching all of that stuff again, reflecting on, or I guess to sort of pick up on what I said before about how the casting of Wilmer Valderrama, of Macaulay Culkin, of Wilson Cruz, seeing them as grown-ups, as, of course, young adults, but as adults rather than teenagers and kids the way we'd seen them before, and reckoning with that, thinking how, in back when I saw the movie originally, of how being struck by their adulthood. And now watching it as someone who's middle-aged, looking back and going, man, they were so young. And wondering about, like, thinking about what life was like back then that allowed for these very young people to be leading the life that they led with virtually no, with almost no interference from anybody else. And thinking about how there were so few guardrails for these very young folks leading these lives back then, and how back then that seemed so mature to me. But now I can't help but think about how young they were.
Right. I mean, I alluded to Michael's mother earlier, and of course she becomes sort of a club kid herself. She, you know, and I think that there are allusions to the fact that, you know, her life has also been one of thwarted desires, perhaps, and that, you know, Michael offers her, as much as he does everyone else, an avenue of escape from that. And she's more than happy to sort of go with him. She even goes with him on the talk show. So it's really striking that, you know, as you say, whatever guardrails there might or perhaps should have been were not there at all.
Exactly, because even with that relationship where we see the mother-son relationship is one of those things that you would think would be an important guardrail, even though he's a very young adult, we see that he's basically been allowed to sort of do whatever he wants his whole life. She's not the kind of mother that's protected him.
Right.
Because we know about all of the bad things that happened to him when he was a kid. You know, her response has always been to sort of be like, well, you go and experience the things that you want to experience, and that's just wonderful, and I will love you and support you and all of that kind of stuff. But without being like a, you know, mom.
Well, I mean, considering who her mother was and, you know.
Of course.
And Mommy Dearest, I mean, maybe that's sort of her response to that.
Which is why, I know, which is why I think that that was a real stunt casting thing by casting her in that role. Because she's playing the opposite of that Mommy Dearest type character here.
Right. No wire hangers for her.
Exactly. Elka is more like, if you want wire hangers, have all the wire hangers you want kind of mom.
Right. So I want to talk a little bit about the murder, because that to me is like where the film obviously takes its most ominous turn. You know, once Michael ends up doing all these drugs but doesn't have the money to pay Angel, and then Angel flies into a rage, and then as it turns out, it's actually Michael's roommate or whoever who sort of bludgeons him to get death, or, well, we think with a hammer. But then it gets even worse, because then Michael injects him with Drano, and then of course after the body starts to smell, they dismember it with knives and put it in a TV box, which they then put in the living room. So just like, and of course the striking part about all of this is that James St. James seems to be learning this from a rat that he's having like a conversation with.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, when Ebert refers to the horror aspects, that's part of what he's talking about, is like, I think this third act sort of shift into, I said earlier, a cotton candy acid trip. Yes. That's kind of how I feel like what the third act sort of makes this real sharp turn. That it works, I think, But I'm also just kind of like, what the fuck did I just watch?
Exactly. And the way that I read all of it was because, of course, what's happening throughout much of the movie, James is completely stoned. Like, you know, he takes way too much, ends up hospitalized at some points in the movie. He's, you know, an addict who needs some help, mm-hmm. which he does get at some point, but he needs help throughout this movie. And so very often when he's like making revelations or discovering something or figuring something out, he's completely stoned when it's happening. So that's what I think is happening when he's making the connection and figuring out what happened to Angel.
Right.
That he's figuring it out when he's completely stoned out of his mind. So that's the weird dream slash hallucination with the rat explains him just kind of figuring this stuff out. Because what really happened, as we see throughout the movie, is that Michael just confessed all of this stuff to James. But of course, James was stoned out of his mind right. when those confessions were made.
Right. And I mean, Michael also confessed it to the police because the police wanted to use him as a mole to take down Dylan McDermott, who's character I cannot remember his name for life of me. So that's really weird.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the only time we get the sort of, at first it's unclear what happened to Angel. I mean, we know that he's dead, but we didn't get like the mm-hmm. we don't get that till the what do we want to call it, the rat interlude, like exactly. maybe the rodent interlude, you know, whatever that is. That's where we sort of learned Michael's own, like, who didn't necessarily initiate this brutal act, mm-hmm. but finished it, as yep. it were, with the Drano, which mm-hmm. eludes me as to why you would take that particular avenue after this poor person's already been bludgeoned half to death. Like,
well, the point is to make sure he's actually dead.
Well, I know, but aren't there better ways to do it than injecting him with Drano?
Well, that would do the job.
Someone watches a little bit too much SVU over here. If we disappear again, reader, listeners, you will know what happened. That I've been injected with Drano. That's mm. what's happened.
I'm saying nothing.
So anyway, so that's that whole dreamy, sort of trippy sequence. And I mean, Michael seems rather, I don't know, what do I want to say? Like, not dismissive, but blasé mm-hmm. about the way he's like, well, I had him go and get me some knives and a TV from Macy. So I had a lot of questions about what the Macy staff must have been thinking, because it's not usual that people buy TVs and knives at the same time. Like, that's mm-hmm. quite an interesting shopping combination.
All right.
I mean, it wouldn't necessarily raise any eyebrows, but nevertheless.
Mm-hmm. They are in New York.
Well, yes, exactly. And this is New York in the late 80s and early 90s, mm-hmm. murder capital of the world. But anyway, not my apologies to our New York City listeners. So that whole sequence happens, and then, of course, Michael goes to jail. And then we sort of flash forward to the present where, you know, James St. James is once again interviewing for this television show. And it's that moment where we see, like, he's kind of seizing control of the story again, mm-hmm. you know, because we have this earlier moment where he thinks that he's written this grand masterpiece,
yes.
only to discover that it's all blank paper, mm-hmm. which, you know, I mean, if you've ever experienced writer's block, or, you know, you had a dream where you did something really important and then you woke up and then you're like, oh fuck, it was actually a dream.
Or more like if you've been completely stoned and thought you were doing something only to realize you hadn't done it at all.
Well, I was speaking of my own experience. I've never been so stoned that I didn't know what I did. So.
No one believes that.
Well, listeners, you can chime in if you wish. Leave us a comment. Anyway, you know, so as he puts it most trenchantly at the very end, because the interviewer seems kind of aghast that James would still be speaking to Michael given all their bad history, he's like, well, he did help to cure my writer's block. And then, so I want to talk about that last frame, because I was just kind of struck by the way after he says that and he has this sort of smug look on his face, the camera just fades to black. Mm-hmm. It's such an interesting way to end, because it's not really, there's no real closure per se. Like, I kind of expected there to be an intertext at the end to be like, well, here's what really happened. Like, Michael's yeah. still certain, but there isn't. It just goes directly to the credits. So it's a really interesting choice for a movie that is so, you know, so firmly grounded in what really happened, or mm-hmm. at least from James's perspective of what happened. Mm-hmm. So, what are some of our closing thoughts on Party Monster? Like, I do think it is one of the more straightforwardly queer movies that we've done, mm-hmm. both in terms of, like, obviously the subject matter, because, you know, both Michael and James St. James, I think James St. James is queer, but even if they're not, there's, a, you know, obviously the queerness of gender performance and all that, But I also think that, you know, there's something interesting about the film's own flaunting of its bad taste. Like, it's obviously not as, like, shall we say, trashy as a typical John Waters film. But I do think that it is kind of like, there is a certain seediness to it as well that I think is very much queer.
Yeah, for me, there's something about, again, the way that the movie for me has aged. That sort of, it's like, I look at it and I look at all of the tragedy and I look at all of that stuff and I look at it and I still go, ah, it was probably still so much fun. Like, there's that way of thinking about queer life at that time, where it's like the fun and the tragedy are just so intertwined with one another.
Yeah. Right. I mean, isn't there, you know, I've been reading this book called About Fire Ireland. Of this, it's by Jack Parlett. It's a history, just came out. It's very good if you haven't read it. But, you know, he's sort of remarking on Fire Island as also this scene of hedonism and exuberance and how it is also tinged with tragedy, both because of, you know, obviously the AIDS crisis, but also, you know, the many deaths that have happened on Fire Island over the years. And, you know, there is this sense that being queer is always a sort of sadness. Sadness just seems to be part of being queer. And I think that one of the things that Party Monster asks us to sit with, and maybe part of the reason that the mainstream critics didn't like it at the time, was because it does sort of force us to confront the ugliness and the sadness and of in the forlornness sometimes of queer experience. And that's not something that people were always really comfortable with.
Yep.
And I think that even queer viewers, especially then at the time, would have been like, what a, like, would have been very reactionary about the negative connotations and this, what this would have as far as the public perception of queer people.
Exactly, because this is at the time when Will and Grace has sort of clawed its way to the top of the public consciousness. So, you know, very different take on queer life sort of in the mainstream.
Ironically enough, Macaulay Culkin would also make a big guest star appearance on Will and Grace, also one of his return to the screen. So I want to just, you know, I want to, as a sort of emblem of the critical reception of this film and how it was met with a fair amount of hostility, I think it has something like a 26% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is not great. But anyway, so Roger Ebert, whose criticism I tend to admire, I think he was a pretty astute reader of film, says, unlike real-life crime movies such as in Cold Blood, they, that is the filmmakers of this one, find no insights into the humanity of their subject, but that may be because Alec was a cipher known only to himself, if that. The movie lacks insight and leaves us feeling sad and empty. Sad for ourselves, not Alec. And maybe it had to be that way. Which I think is both true, but also I think not true in the sense that I think it misses the point of the movie. And I think that it sells short what Culkin is doing with his performance in this role. What do you think?
What do you think?
Well, because, you know, when I first started watching this movie this time, I was like, I said to you, I think Culkin and Green are in very different movies. But I changed my opinion as I watched the film, and certainly even more now, more so now that we've been talking about it, because I do think that Culkin really is giving us a tragicomic performance. And I think he's really excavating the multi-layered tragedy of Alec's life and his sort of persona.
Yeah.
So I think that it's selling the movie short to say that it doesn't make us sad for Michael, because I actually think it does.
Yeah.
Because I think that if you think about it more critically and you look at more complexly at what Culkin is doing performance-wise, I think you can really see that. And you see it emerge like in certain moments, like when we see him standing in the club with bruises under his eyes. Like, you see the physical toll. You know, as I alluded to earlier, like, his body is literally rendered up as a vulnerability. Like, we see his skin, we see his butt, among other things. Not to exoticize or fetishize, but I'm just saying that, like, there are these moments when we see the sad little boy underneath of all the face paint. And I think that that's something that I'm not sure that Ebert, unsurprisingly as a straight critic, would not necessarily grasp in the same way that we do.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
And
I mean, because I'm also, you know, to refer back to what I said earlier, like, if you look at figures like Hedwig, or you look at Tiger King, whose real name is eluding me, like, they too, for all of their theatricality and all of the sort of vulgarity of their respective movies, there you can sense the rawness and the emotional trauma underneath of it all. So I think that that's worth celebrating this film for, which is why we chose it for Queens of the Beast, aside from the obvious connections to the Culkin dynasty and its continued relevance.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that there's something in it. I didn't realize this when I picked it, but it is obviously the 20 years since the film was released. So I do think that, you know, this is very much, as we tend to do here at Queens, emblematic of a certain period of queer filmmaking. Like,
yes.
You know, this has the look and the feel of, even though, of course, it's about the 80s, it has the feel of that early 2000s mm-hmm. indie gay
yes,
drama.
Yes, it does.
Which I love. I mean, there's...
But also sort of the fun of... I would say it's sort of like... It has sort of the starkness of some of the dramas that came in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
But a bit more of the fun of the 2000 queer movies that came out.
Right. I mean, because the thing is like, you are actually have cast real talented actors.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, all the people who are in this are people who've already shown that they have the bona fides to
yep.
play actual, like, roles. Like, they're not just indie actors who maybe have two or three credits on their IMDb list, but are actual people with, you know, actual
mm-hmm.
resumes.
Yes.
And I think that that makes a big difference in terms of what the story can accomplish.
Right. It does. And for me, it's the... That sort of looking at not just the careers that all of those folks had before they were in this, but sort of the careers they've had since then and the successes they've had and the different kinds of roles they've portrayed since then for pretty much everybody in the movie is, for me, it's a reminder when I look back at this movie to not just sort of take it seriously, but to really think about the care that went into the project because of those folks. Those are all serious actors.
Mm-hmm.
They all would have put a lot of care and concern into their performances and would care about the vehicle that they were
right.
were working in. Like, they wouldn't all be like, well, they offered me enough money, so I showed up
to
do this.
Right, aside from the fact that they're probably not getting paid all that much to be in this movie
exactly.
to begin with.
Exactly, and for the caliber of a lot of those folks, for where they were at the time,
right.
they wouldn't have been able to pay them what they would have been worth.
Yes.
So it's like, these are folks you guess would care about this movie.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, Seth Green has come off his success in Austin Powers, Wilmer
mm-hmm.
Valderrama is starring in that 70s show as this
mm-hmm.
movie is being made. Dylan McDermott, what was the famous show he was in?
Oh, good lord, I can't remember off the top of my head now.
The Practice? No. Something like that. One of those legal dramas, I think. So anyway, as you say, like, they all would have been, were, you know, if not on the A-list, pretty close to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that also is worth considering when we look at what this film is doing and how it's engaging with the ethos of the time, shall
mm-hmm.
we say.
Yep.
Well, that seems like a really good place to stop. So give us a few minutes to freshen up, powder our noses, and we'll be right back to do our deep cuts. Well, we haven't done a deep cut in a while. Usually, you know, when we do these special segments, it's me harassing you about some idiotic Twitter drama that you don't care about, nor should you. But today I thought we'd switch things up because this is one that I have seen before and
mm-hmm.
that you have seen before. And so I thought it would be worthwhile to sort of excavate. You alluded
mm-hmm.
to some of what you wanted to talk about. Did you want to elaborate on anything?
Exactly. So for this deep cut, I'm actually going to switch things up since I talked about a bunch of what I was going to say about this movie being sort of an interesting sort of early 2000s take on a slightly earlier period in time. So there's already this kind of nostalgia factor kind of baked into it. But I'm actually going to talk about Macaulay Culkin's butt instead.
Go on.
Because Macaulay Culkin's butt, particularly in this movie, the way that it's shown on screen, had an impact on me as a person. And of course, I'm being silly. But I did actually want to talk about more of something that I talked about a little bit earlier. And that idea of seeing these actors who we knew as younger folks, as kids and teenagers before, sort of reemerge as young men. And seeing how they perform. I wanted to talk a little bit about Macaulay's turn here of displaying his body in this way.
Uh-huh.
When, of course, he, of all of the actors in this movie, he had been the one who had been known most as a child star as opposed to like a teenage star or
mm-hmm.
something like that. He was a little kid when he sort of burst onto the scene and became world famous. And so to see him portraying his body in this much more adult way, seeing it when I watched the movie back then was kind of like, oh, wow, he's kind of all grown up and he's doing the thing that you do when you were a child actor. Now you want to be an adult.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, there are a couple things you can do. Bearing yourself on screen is one of the things you can do to say, hey, I'm a grown up now. But it, the thing that sort of impressed me and made this something that I think had a personal impact on me was a bunch of things about Macaulay Culkin's persona in this role.
just because he's still a fairly young man. I believe he was, what, 22 or something like that when he was in this movie.
Yeah.
So he's still a fairly young man, but, you know, 22 is a grown man,
right,
as opposed to being a kid. But Macaulay, still to this day, but especially back then, still looked so boyish that, you know, when I looked at him at the time, it oddly reminded me a lot of myself. As, you know, someone who, as a grown man, still was mistaken for being a kid for a very long time and wanting to be feel comfortable asserting myself as an adult and be doing all of the things that adults do, but knowing that everyone still sees me as a kid.
Right.
And I remember going through a phase where it's like I actually kind of put myself on display the way that Michael does in this movie. Especially in that scene where he's wearing the, like, hospital dress made out of the mask, where his body's on display in that way, where we do see his butt. You know, I was that same kind of twinkish young 20-something guy, then, like, I did kind of the same thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because I, you know, I would play on that sort of, like, same sort of innocent boyish appearance, but I'm a grown-up, so I can do these things.
Right.
Like, that actually was kind of an influence on me.
Mm-hmm.
At the time. So that, you know, that's why I wanted to talk about that a little bit as a deep cut. But upon review, 20 years later, being middle-aged and not a young twink anymore.
But still looking very young.
Thank you very much. Your check will show up tomorrow for that.
I accept nature's credit.
But looking at the movie now as someone who's middle-aged and seeing how young Macaulay Culkin looked in that scene, it's like, I don't look at him as sort of a role model or as an object of desire. I look at him and I'm like, I kind of want to protect him. Like, that's the feeling that I have now. And the deep cut for me is how, as we age and we see images that kind of remind us of ourselves when we were younger, we might feel differently about those images because of the place we're in our lives now. Because Macaulay Culkin and I are around the same age. Like, we kind of, you know, it's like I grew up watching him grow up and all that kind of stuff. Like, I think I'm like a year older than he is.
Yeah, he was born in 1980, so he was 22, like, when this movie was made.
Exactly, so I'm a year older than him, so we're pretty close. But seeing young him at this point, I don't identify with him in quite the same way, because at this point I'm like, I really am a grown-up now. And when I see young him now, I don't think, oh, person who's like me. I think person who needs my protection.
I just need to pause here and just say that this is why I enjoy the deep cut section, because I actually find that really fascinating and moving at the same time. Like, I think that, as you say, like, our relationships with stars and with movies change over time. And I really appreciate that perspective, because I think it's very helpful and dovetails with what I was saying earlier about, like, why I find Culkin's performance so great in this movie, because he does what you've pointed out as, you know, because of Culkin, who he is as a child star, there is that vulnerability that I think is always there, that is very evident.
Yeah, but it's not just that, it's also his physical appearance. Like, at 22, he still looked very much like a kid. Like, you know, of course, he's just taller, you know?
Right.
But his face looked almost the same as it did when he was in freaking Home Alone, you know?
Right. I mean, he still looks almost the same. It's really uncanny. Like, he has remained sort of physiologically the same much more than, say, Kieran has. Like, he looks very different than when he appeared in Home Alone as Kevin's younger brother. Like, he looks like a Culkin, but he doesn't look that like that anymore. Whereas I think there is still something very boyish about the now mid-40s Macaulay. If you see him in, like, American Horror Story, for example, where he still has that boyishness, laced with a little bit of haggardness, which I think is deliberate, but also a testament to what he's put his body through over the last several decades. Which, obviously, as I said, which adds another layer of richness to his portrayal of Michael. Anything else that you wanted to say?
No, I don't want
to. Okay, well, mine is not nearly as sophisticated as that. So I watched this film probably in 2008, like, I was visiting a friend, or maybe 2009. It was there, somewhere thereabouts. So not too long after it came out. But, you know, I had already seen Macaulay sort of emerge into public life again. And, you know, as someone who also grew up, I'm slightly younger than Macaulay, but I've too also watched him in various things, in Home Alone, in Pagemaster, in Richie Rich. And so, you know, when I heard that he was in a gay movie, I was like, oh my god, he's so cute and I love him, and I, like, you know, I can't wait to see him in this movie. So I would have been probably 20 23, 24 when mm-hmm. I watched this. So, you know, it was just exciting. It was that moment of my life where I was sort of discovering all this indie queer cinema that I had not yet seen for whatever reason. Like, a friend of mine had a subscription to Here TV, and I think that's probably where we watched it, because they used to stream all these things. Mm-hmm. On demand. It wasn't called streaming back then. So it was just kind of exciting and, dare I say, a little titillating mm-hmm. to see, as you say, Macaulay Culkin's butt. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's what we should title this podcast, right? Is Macaulay Culkin's butt.
And it was cute.
It was a cute butt. Like, it's a very he's very twinky.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just it was exciting for me as a mid-20-something to sort of see this. And I don't know that I necessarily, like, appreciated the film and all of its thematic complexity the way I do now. I mean, I wasn't quite the sophisticate that I am these days.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have these strangled elocutions. Actually, that is a complete that's a lie. That is a complete lie that has been a part of my persona since the moment I was born. But anyway, so for me, the appeal of this film lay in just sort of getting to see this very famous star play gay. Like, mm-hmm. there was still a novelty to that. Nowadays, now everybody does it. Exactly. Like, it's a prestige thing now. But and still, in the mid to late 2000s, it was still a big deal. Like, mm-hmm. it was still like, you know, it would still raise eyebrows.
But exactly. It's like, but again, especially as someone who had been a child star, that's one of the things that you could do to be like, I'm a grown up now. It's like, you can show your body, you can play gay. There are a couple of other things like that you could do to be like, look at me, I'm not a kid anymore.
Right.
And so this movie sort of did double duty for him for that. I was thinking about how the Harry Potter kid, you know, dropped his pants and be like, I'm an adult now.
Right. Yep. That's a very good analog, actually. Like, mm-hmm. You know, his starring role on stage in Equus. Mm-hmm. Like, not just in the movies, but in front of a live, like, audience.
Yeah.
Like, you're right. That, you know, exposing one's body or being gay or both, in the case of this one, is a very good way for child stars to indicate that they have matured mm-hmm. into adulthood. Fascinating. So, as I said, mine is not nearly as sophisticated or nuanced as what you have described, but, you know, as I said, it was an important moment for me where I watched a lot of the movies that would subsequently come to sort of solidify mm-hmm. and sort of wish fulfillment for me as a mid-20s gay kid, mm-hmm. still sort of trapped in mm-hmm. Appalachia
exactly.
and not being able to have, and not having a real community
yeah.
as such. Like, although the person I was with was one of the few other gay people, gay men, that I knew mm-hmm. in that time of my life.
And I was going to say, so you're saying that this didn't, like, parallel you, like, your club kid experiences when you were out doing all of that stuff?
Right, yeah, when I was in my heroin days, like, it just didn't quite, you know, didn't kind of jive. That would come later. That was grad school. Right.
And I'm just here to say, you could go out clubbing and not do heroin. I am living proof that one can do that.
I remain skeptical of that claim. Well, that seems like a good place to conclude our deep cuts. So, we are very happy that we're back on a regular schedule with you all. We were doing some traveling, not that you need to know all the details of our life, but that's part of why people tune in, is because we share with our listeners.
We share.
So, we're happy to be back with you on a regular basis. We are now a feline household. I know we alluded to our new adoptee a few weeks ago, but Tigranes, Tigger for short, Tiggy Newton also for short, has really taken to us. He's actually sleeping on the bed with us as we speak. So we are now inhabiting the sort of gay life that we always dreamed of.
Mm-hmm.
Two men and a cat. Like,
exactly. Like, I gave up on all the club kid dreams a long time ago. This has been the queer life dream for years now.
I'm glad that I mentioned that, because I almost forgot to mention the cat drama in this movie.
Oh, yes.
Where DJ Keoki and Michael basically fool around in a dumpster and adopt a cat, but then Michael gives the cat cocaine, it's the cocaine that he gives to the cat, which, of course, at some point, the cat dies. It's horrifying, and I think the extraneous cat death is never a good thing in a movie. So that was one critique I have of this film. So that's what I had to say about that. So I'm glad I brought up the cat, because that reminded me of what I almost forgot to mention.
Yes, don't give cats cocaine.
That is the takeaway. If you take nothing else away from this discussion of this movie, that is it. Do not give cats cocaine.
And make them get their own.
Well, anyway, now that we've encouraged drug use among the feline population, I'm not going to bother asking Aaron where you can find him on social media, because I know that he's not really a social media-ite like I am.
I mean, you can ask, it's fine.
But you'll say the same thing that you say every week.
Yes.
which is that you can find him where you can find me.
Exactly.
So you can find me a little bit of everywhere. You can find me on Twitter at TJ Weston, the number 3. I'm holding firm to Twitter, despite the fact that Elon Musk is a fucking lunatic. You can also find me on Instagram, where I do post pretty frequently under both my own name, Thomas Weston, the number 3, but also on our Instagram, our Queens of the Bees handle, which of course is at Queens of the Bees. We are much more consistent over there. We have sort of thumbnail film reviews of everything from, oh, I don't know, we've done Cocaine Bear, we've done the Rock with Rock not Rock Hudson, Dwayne Johnson. We have done movies, old movies, new movies, whatever. TV shows, we do it all over there. So it's a nice little thumbnail for the stuff that we don't have time to do it full episode.
It sounds very promiscuous.
Of course it is. That's part of being queer. I know. Scandalous.
Wow.
Yes. Very very essentialist of me. Anyway, so please follow us over on Instagram at Queens of the Bees, or Queens of the BS, as you would type it out. You can also follow my Substack newsletter, Omnivorous, where I do frequently write about gay stuff. And all sorts of other things. That's why it's called Omnivora. So please do remember to check that out. Subscribe if you will. And please rate or review us wherever you get your podcast. Just so you know that if you can, we would love you to sign up on Spotify or listen to us through Spotify. The more Spotify listeners we have, we can get Anchor to sponsor us. So if you would be so kind, we would greatly appreciate it. But nevertheless, wherever you listen to us, please rate us or review us. That also helps build visibility, which for a little podcast like ours is very important. So I think that's all the stuff I have for you this week. It's been a pretty exciting episode. We have a fun Mommy Dearest episode coming up for Mother's Day, so that'll be fun. So for Queens of the Bees, I'm your co-host TJ.
And I'm Aaron.
And we will talk to you soon.